And welcome back to Power Hour, The Athletic's Tuesday National College Football Podcast, hosted by yours truly, Nicole Auerbach. And I am thrilled, as always, to be joined by my friend and colleague, Michael Felder, from Stadium, to break down the biggest storylines in college football in an hour or less. And if you enjoy this podcast and this podcast feed, just a reminder to subscribe, rate, and review The Andy Staples Show and Friends. 5 stars, because much like Ari Wasserman's favorite recruits, that's what we're worth. And Felder, it was a busy morning already. We're recording this on Tuesday. And honestly, before I was even awake for the day, Virginia Tech decided they were done with Justin Fuente.
Yeah, this feels like it's been a couple, you can say it's been a couple years in the making. You could say it's been a couple months in the making. But they were like, you know what, we got to get rid of this baby in the bathwater. So let's go ahead and let's find something new. So, yeah, I would love to hear what you think about it, because Virginia Tech is a very interesting place to me.
Yeah, I think you're right that this has felt like we've been kind of on this slow march towards this decision for a couple of years. I mean, I remember, was it last season where there was like an announcement that athletic director Whit Babcock was going to have a press conference. And so everyone's like, all right, he made the decision. And they had to correct themselves and say like, no, we're just doing an end of the season thing. Justin Fuente is keeping his job. So there's been obviously speculation around this for a number of years, because it's not worked all that well. This is someone who started out well, 10-4, coastal title in the first season, 9-4 the second year. And then it's just been losing records, a 5-5 start. They snapped their bowl streak. All of these things that we're just not used to seeing out of Virginia Tech have happened. And it's a little bit, I'm thinking back to when they hired Fuente, and it was considered a slam dunk hire. This was a rising star coach from Memphis. You know, he was keeping Bud Foster, so there was going to be some continuity on the defensive side from the Frank Beamer era. All of these pieces seemed to be falling into place on the front end, and ultimately it didn't work. He's lost a ton of players to the transfer portal. There's been a lot of questions.
Players who are
that.
Doing good things.
Players who are having great success elsewhere, including quarterbacking at Tennessee. He's missed on the quarterback position at Virginia Tech, struggled there. The defense has done things, again, that is supposed to be the backbone identity of this program and isn't. So I just keep thinking back to when he was hired, and just, I don't know that I necessarily would have saw that this unfold the way that it did, but I don't know how much of that is following Frank Beamer or what Frank Beamer was able to build and specific things to that era of Virginia Tech. How much of it is Justin Fuente? I don't know, but it's certainly a very interesting case study in this in a year where like there's a lot of different openings. This is actually a very interesting one to me.
There's a couple different things. One, I don't know if this is like a very popular saying, but it's the thing that I've always heard, is you never want to be the guy after the guy,
right?
And obviously we saw that not work go well for Jimbo Fisher. Even though he won a national championship, we saw it not go well for him long term at Florida State. You look at those, like, you see these things, like the coach that comes after the coach who makes the program or builds the program or is the program, a lot of times has a rough time because they're so, Lloyd Carr at Michigan going to Rich Rod and it just being like, what's happening?
Yep.
So I think it's going to be really, I think that's part of it. But I also think that Virginia Tech is a unique program. They are, I don't want to say that they're very similar to Clemson. I don't want to say they're very close to Clemson, but they are very similar to Clemson in terms of a very small, intimate community that relies on that edge to build a family atmosphere in their state. Like, they are not – Virginia Tech is not – they have produced a lot of NFL players, but they are not a football factory. They are a family program. As evidenced by, what are the brothers? We're all of them, the Fullers, right? Yeah. So they're a family first program. And I think Fuente, because of the success that he had obviously at Memphis, because Virginia Tech fans did earnestly want to move that offense forward,
yep,
it was a good hire. It didn't go well. And I think a big part of why it didn't go well was trying to marry old with new, trying to figure out what they're going to do. But Virginia Tech's a program that has dominated in the Tidewater, the H2O region. They have dominated, and they made their hay. And this is a conflict that Virginia Tech has. They made their hay in a lot of the same way that Nebraska, A&M did, living off this idea of the 12th man, living off this idea of like scrappiness. And then I'm referencing
the lunch pail.
I'm referencing things that are in the 90s or early 2000s. And like for people that younger people or people who don't know about this, who got to the game a little bit later than I did, but like Nebraska had the most robust walk-on program in college football. Virginia Tech had an extremely robust walk-on program as well. And they lived off these kids who their goal was to play for Virginia Tech. And then they went and found guys. Not found guys. That's the wrong word. They went and got guys like Michael Vick, yeah, like Lee Suggs, like Macho Harris. And they were like, come here. We're going to get you to where you want to be. At one point, they had the longest streak of 10-win seasons. They are a team that had been going to bowls forever. They invented Thursday night football because they lived off, and this goes back to, again, not to give people a history lesson, but there was a time that Florida State and Miami both were two programs that said anytime, any place, anywhere, we'll play you. This renegade mentality, and Virginia Tech also created that renegade mentality because they invented that Thursday night game. I've been to Lane Stadium. Have you been to Lane?
Yes.
You been to Lane on a Thursday night?
Not on a Thursday, but.
Ooh. I'm going to tell you, I don't know what they did with the foundation there. I don't know what they got going with the pilings, but that stadium moves. And the way that it moves is wild. And I'll never forget, you know, Bobby Frazier. Bobby Frazier played. He was a point guard for UNC. Bobby Frazier saw me fall down the stairs at Lane Stadium one night because the stadium started moving and I missed a step. And if you fall at Lane, you're going down.
I think there's maybe some of this is because some of the stadiums have been renovated, but there's probably like three stadiums that shake and move.
Yeah.
It would be Camp Randall, Beaver Stadium, and Lane. Like yeah. It's a different world. I'm interested in what you said too. We'll move on to some, you know, on field stuff as well. But what you're talking about, like where they can get players now.
Yeah.
You know, they have pretty good facilities. They need to pay more for probably their staff, the assistants, and different stuff.
It's a huge conflict, though. The conflict
right, of who they are.
The conflict that they face, and this is a very real conflict, and they're not the only team that has this issue. Wisconsin has to deal with it as well. There's a lot of teams that have to deal with this issue. Do we chase a guy who is local or semi-local? Do we chase a guy who is a five-star and we devote resources to that guy who's a four-star? Or do we take the three-star that we know we can become a player in 2 years? And they legit, like, that's a problem. And the fan base, I believe, is like, there's a lot of folks who are like, we got to get this guy. He's in our backyard. Knowing that guy, whether it's what Deshaun Hand or somebody, they're probably going to end up at Alabama. So you're diverting resources from 2, 3, 4 players who you could take that are with quote unquote 2 or 3 stars that you can build into players.
So where should they go in that fork in the road with the next coaches?
What is the next coach going to get paid? $3 million? That's a $3 million question.
Yeah.
Is how you divert, how you allot resources. Because you can't just not try. You can't just not try to get, who's the kid from DC? Rakeem Jarrett? You can't just not try to get him. He ended up going to Maryland.
Yeah.
You can't just not try to get him. And I truly believe Virginia Tech is one of those places, if you can get kids on campus enough, you can get them to go to school there. It's just a matter of getting them on campus and getting them around the program and getting them – well, let me stop myself. During the Beamer era, it was about getting those kids on campus and getting them around the program. And then they feel at home. They – especially now with the connectivity. And I think Fuente had a different – excuse me. Fuente had a different method, was not nearly as well-liked, obviously, as Beamer was. And I hate that I keep saying Frank Beamer because great guy. I've done a couple things with him, and he's fantastic. But this is not what this is about. It's not about going backwards. It's about moving forward. And so the goal for them is going to be someone who can connect to getting back into the Tidewater, hardcore. You can connect to the Tidewater. Someone who can reach down, because people don't think about this a lot, but Virginia Tech used to have a straight up and down line to Charlotte. They got kids from Charlotte, and they got them consistently. So you need to get back down to Charlotte, and you need to get into Raleigh. You need to get into Eastern North Carolina, and then you also have to reach up and get into Pittsburgh, and you have to go a little bit west to get into Ohio. So that, to me, is job one for the, whoever the next guy is. Honestly, I know I referenced Clemson earlier, but I think that they do need somebody who is like Dabo Swinney, who – realizes someone who feels lucky to have the job and then works really hard to restore all of their relationships.
That last sentence is what I think so many of these programs that are making changes this year are looking for. I think we're up to 12 open jobs right now.
Yeah,
two
it's
weeks
a lot.
To go. It's a lot. So we'll keep an eye on it. It'll be all over this feed. Andy's on top of it as well. And you know, as we know on the Saturday night feeds, you can pretty much tell whose time is coming up. But let's get into some on-field stuff, because I wanted to talk about a team that I just feel is not getting the due that they deserve, because I think we were so distracted by Oklahoma being undefeated, and we were distracted by, you know, Caleb Williams and Spencer Rattler and all these different things that were happening over there. But the team that's playing the best in the Big 12, you could argue, is Oklahoma State, who has an actual college football playoff case. I mean, this is a, you know, you could go through the stats defensively. They're in the top 10 in a number of key categories. They're playing well offensively. They've got a win over Baylor, which is now going to be borderline top 10 win. It wins over, you know, teams that are over 500. The resume has all the things that the playoff committee looks for. I think we not us specifically, but people write off teams with one loss in the playoff race all the time. People did that with Oklahoma. They did it for the whole Big 12. But I think the Oklahoma State Cowboys are pretty well positioned, assuming they went out here and they're playing well and they could do it, to make the playoff. And I don't think people are really appreciating what that team is doing. I don't know if people are watching them. I don't know if people are paying attention to the Cowboys.
Well, if you're not paying attention, that's on you. We can't help you with that.
But we can tell them what to know to catch up, and then they can pay attention.
Well, what do you like about Oklahoma State?
I just think it's, this has been a weird year, right, where we've talked about, you know, certain teams having identities that are different. I think defensively they're good. And this is something that we don't always associate with Oklahoma State. I mean, they're number 8 nationally in scoring defense, number 7 yards per play, tied for the most sacks in the country. Like, they get after it defensively, and they're winning games that way. And I just think that's cool. We're not used to it.
So the thing for me, good grief, for Stadium, I did a Tape Don't Lie on Oklahoma State a couple weeks ago talking about this defense, because the way that they earn their money, the way that these guys make hay is unique. They show cover zero. They show cover zero, and basically for people that don't know, cover zero is no high safeties. They line up for – there are times – it was the Texas game, or right after the Texas. It was in the Texas game, and the week after the Texas game is when I did the video. But they lined up with a straight line across, 4 yards off the ball. Every player was in 4 yards of the line of scrimmage. That's scary. That's confusing to quarterbacks. They don't know what to do. And then the thing that they do that's really cool is they mug their linebackers up. So they have two linebackers. They usually play in nickel, which is five defensive backs, hence the nickel. It's worth 5 cents. You get five players. Don't ask about dime. That's six defensive backs, even though a dime's worth 10. But the reality of it is they line up in nickel, five guys. They've got corner, slot corner, corner, safety, safety, and those guys play man across the board. And then they have two linebackers in the game, and those guys are mugged up. And they're mugged up, which means they're lined up at the line of scrimmage, standing up in gaps. Makes the offensive line have to account for them. And then the thing that they do, because when you show that look, a quarterback instantly thinks, oh, they're going to blitz. Oh, they're bringing pressure, so we need to keep a tight end in. We need to keep a running back in. So they're eliminating possible receivers by showing that look. And then on snap, those guys spring out to what are considered those hot routes. They spring out into the space that you would usually run your inside slants. And as they drop, they hit those spots, what it does is forces the quarterback to hold the ball a little bit longer, which leads to their ability to get him off his line, get him off his mark, get him out of time. And I think it's beautiful. Like, what they do defensively has been really, really fun to watch. With the exception of Cincinnati, I think they play the most aggressive man coverage in college football. It's really awesome to see the way that they get it done. And I don't know, like, for me, they're generally appointment viewing, because it's really, like, one, it's a thing that I could never do. It's a thing I would never do. I was never a man guy. I was always a zone guy. So it's really cool to watch Oklahoma State, Cincinnati do it. But it also is cool from an identity standpoint, where we're seeing Gundy. This is kind of the reverse Nick Saban.
Yep.
Where we're seeing Gundy embrace that this is the way that I have to win, so I'm going to do it. Same as Nick Saban realizing, I've got to score a bunch of points, otherwise I'm going to lose. Same as Pat Narduzzi this season with Pitt. If you don't want to go for the greatest of all time to compare Mike Gundy to Nick Saban, compare him to Pat Narduzzi. And it's this idea of Narduzzi wants to play good defense, and he wants to shut you down and confuse you defensively, but that's not working so well this year. So what do we have to do? We've got to score points. And Kenny Pickett has become a really good quarterback, has become an NFL first-round possible quarterback because they've leaned into a strength, and I think that's really cool for Oklahoma State. So if you're not watching them, you need to. The way that they play defense is really fun, and I'll tell you what, to take it back to Oklahoma, who you referenced earlier, this is something I mentioned with Caleb Williams. It's different, not better.
Yep.
It's a smaller playbook. Well, guess what? Dave Aranda's a genius. So he can make you look dumb. And then we're going to see Iowa State, and then we're going to see Oklahoma State. So we're going to have to see how quickly Lincoln Riley can get Caleb Williams ready for games where these teams know who they are, know what they do, and they can confuse him. And I think Oklahoma State's a prime example, obviously, for the Bedlam game. I think Iowa State fits in there with the way that they're always able to get two over one, three over two, four over three. And obviously Baylor was already able to do it. We'll see if these other two teams can do it as well, because we could be looking at a three-loss Oklahoma team by the end of the season.
Well, let's jump to our Flavor of the Week segment, because sure. I know that you wanted to get into Oklahoma and Baylor a little bit there. So this is, we talk about something we're cooking, which is a great time of year for cooking, and yes, also something we like on the field. So let's stick with that Oklahoma Baylor game and Dave Aranda and what he was able to do to that Oklahoma offense.
So they disguised their coverages and they took away first reads. They looked, essentially, they did what I do on Mondays, and they looked, and of course they did. They get paid to do it. And they looked at what Caleb Williams does. They realized, okay, he likes to look hard right early. They took away the hard right early. They took away and then, oh my God, there's a play. I got it right here. There's a play on, there's a play where they sit down. I don't have the number written down. There's a play where they sit down. Baylor shows blitz. They show six-man pressure. He goes to look for his hot. They're impressed, so the hot's disrupted. And then there are two guys sitting there waiting and watching for where he's going to run. Two linebackers, one for either side, waiting to see where he runs because Oklahoma had to keep, they had to keep a running back in the block so I don't have to cover him, and waiting to watch where he runs so that they can track him down. There's a third and three, I believe, in the second quarter where they bring where Baylor brings pressure, and then they saw him off because they have their, they keep a running back in Green Dog principles in terms of if the running back blocks, then you add yourself to the blitz, but he doesn't fully blitz. What he does is approach, occupy, and then sprint to the side. And I think it's beautiful. And I think that the way that they play defense is really fun. Remarkable that with Bernard not it, like when Bernard was out, like they're still making things happen, which is really cool. Because Bernard, I thought, was their best defensive player coming into the season. And to not have him and still produce, that was great. And then watching, which made them better as a football team, right? Because then you get the rise of Dylan Doyle. And, like, Bernard doesn't play a little bit earlier, and then he's kind of – he doesn't play – what is his game? He missed Oklahoma State game. Then we see Doyle step up, make plays. Now you've got two guys who can make plays. You throw in Petrie. These guys are – they – like, the thing I like about watching Baylor play is they know when they messed up, and they all look at each other, and they're like, that's on me, I did this, instead of where were you? And those are two completely different things. And that is about teaching. That is about – that's about teaching and understanding – like, this is a group of guys that clearly they watch film together. And not just film together in meetings, but film together in, like, they watch film together, like, in their spare time. Because they're looking at each other, not like, what are you doing? But like, that was my bad. I didn't see this thing. And they're very communicative, which I think is good. But to get back to flavor of the week, for me, I'm going to go to the other side of the ball. I talk a lot of defense, but I love what Gary Bohan has done. I've liked him since I saw him when we were out in Redondo Beach at the Elite 11. Like, this dude, he's got the ability to throw the football. He's from Earl, Arkansas, and they love catfish. And I also am a person who loves catfish. I know it's controversial. Like, people view them as a bottom feeder. But the thing that I like about Baylor and relating this back to Arkansas, to catfish, is catfish don't have a size that they grow to. Did you know that?
I have no knowledge about catfish.
Catfish grow as big. They're like goldfish. They will get as big as they're able to.
Okay. Just based on what they eat?
Based on what they eat, but also based on, like, if you keep a catfish in a tank, mm-hmm. if the tank is 10 gallons, you're going to get a catfish that's, you know, X size. But if you keep them in a 60-gallon tank, they're going to get way bigger. They expand into the space. They don't have size constraints from a body standpoint. Hmm. So they just keep growing. It's the same thing as when you see guys out there noodling and they're picking up these 100-pound catfish. That catfish lives in a river or in a lake. They can just get as big as they want, and they got plenty of food. So the point here is, and I had some of the best catfish I've had when I was in Little Rock in 2016, covering one of those Pulaski Academy games. But the point is Baylor also is a team with their quarterback from Arkansas who gets as big as the tank. And this offense, if you feed it and give it space, it's going to keep expanding. That should scare teams. That should scare whoever they play in the Big 12 championship game. That should scare folks because this team is ready to grow. And you watch the way that Bohannon runs, and I love his decisiveness. He's ready to rock and roll. This is one of those guys, good grief, to reference a movie, it's like Heat. These guys at the drop of a dime, they're ready to rock and roll. And that's what he is. This guy brings the heat. And I love that about him. And you throw in Smith and Ebner and their ability to to stress you horizontal with a run while immediately hitting vertical, they will grow as big as the tank. And I think for them, the tank is, right now at least, that tank is huge. So I love it.
You are just the king of metaphors. This has been my main takeaway of doing this show with you. Okay, so my flavor of the week is a little bit more convoluted, but we talked about
you're saying mine wasn't convoluted.
Well, yours is also convoluted. So we talked about this last week, but I had a Friendsgiving over the weekend.
Nice.
The turkey came out great. Thanks for asking. It was very moist, flavorful.
How'd you cook it?
I did it in the oven it was 325, about 3 hours total, 2 hours breast.
Whole bird.
Okay. About 18 pounds. Nice. But yeah, the whole deal, the defrosting, the brine, the rub day of, all that stuff.
You go butter under the skin?
No, I put the rub. I got like this rub from William Sonoma. It's really good. It's like all these herbs and stuff, and it goes under the skin. So wildly successful. As we discussed, everyone needs to put a little bit of respect on the people who make the turkey. It is a lot more work than people realize. And if it's bad, it ruins the meal and people just don't appreciate the amount of effort that goes into it. But I also made my mom's go-to side dish, which is very, very easy. It's a corn souffle. Incredibly easy to make. But delicious. Good. And it's always one of the most popular things at Thanksgiving table. And I have started to make it and bring it to potluck things. And so I made it with the turkey and the gravy and everything I brought up. And it was predictably basically the first thing out at the meal. And, you know, it's interesting because, like, before my mom started making this, I don't think I ever would have thought, like, oh, I need corn souffle. Like, this is going to be my number one side dish. This is the thing that I need on this day. And I appreciate it. It's a little bit out there, right? Like, my brain, you know, growing up would have been turkey, mashed potatoes, maybe some green beans, right? It would have gone to the more classic mm-hmm. side dishes. But now it's the corn souffle. It's the number one thing. It's the first scoop I want on my plate. And I think that I have finally started to, my friends and family are also starting to adopt that mindset because they've tried it. My flavor of the week here is the ACC, and it's more specifically Wake Forest, Pitt, the teams that people are starting to say, oh my God, can you imagine that this is the ACC championship game we're heading towards? Like, imagine how disappointed people must be, how unexcited people must be. You know what? They're the corn souffle for me right now. The ACC has some of the best quarterbacks in the country. I deeply enjoy watching Sam Hartman. I love the weird mesh. I love, like, they're such a unique offense. They're incredibly entertaining. They score in like a second. But they do something different. We were talking about Oklahoma State doing something different defensively. Wake does something different offensively. And then Kenny Pickett, we were talking about. We love Kenny Pickett. We love seeing what he's doing this season, having all of this success, growing as a passer, all of the different things. I don't think that we need to say the ACC championship game sucks or this is what a down season because Clemson is down. When we have these incredible teams to watch, like when Brennan Armstrong comes back, Virginia is must-see TV. Like, there is a lot going on in the ACC, but people are looking for the turkey and the mashed potatoes, and they're not realizing that we have the corn souffle and it's good, and people should be watching these teams. I don't care if they're eliminated from the playoff conversation. These are fun offensive teams, really entertaining. And if that is the championship game matchup, if it is Wake and Pitt, it's going to be a blast. So my flavor of the week is also a little bit of a rant because I just got tired of that immediately just because Clemson wasn't going to be there. People are acting like the new emerging teams or different teams having like these incredible seasons is somehow bad. And I just think like the ACC has been a blast.
Yeah, it has. Who you have to rank these quarterbacks. What order do you put them in? Like top three, top four?
I mean, probably pick it one. Probably.
And then who?
Man, I mean, I probably go Hartman and then Brennan Armstrong. But Brennan Armstrong is like
more Sam Howell.
Yeah, I would probably. Well, but like consistency and what he's working with. Yeah, I mean, that's probably the order I got. And then Brennan Armstrong is like the chaos agent. Like he can do crazier things.
I think I still go Howell 1, Pickett 2, and then Hartman 3. I think Armstrong is incredibly productive, but I also think that it's hard. It's not easy.
They have the best quarterback group, and it's not close this year.
Yeah, they have the if these guys were on other teams, more people would be talking about them, that's for sure.
Yes.
I think Howell's the ability to – the fact that he has, what is that, 4 or 5 100-yard rushing games?
Right.
It's insane.
Yes.
But it's also one of those things where it also hasn't hurt his, like, he's an NFL passer stock where it would hurt some other guys depending on what they
it's
look like.
It's not becoming what he's – he's not a running quarterback. Yeah.
So, no, I still think – I think Howell's had a really good season. So, I would I like Howell. I like Pickett. I mean, I like Brennan Armstrong. I think he's amazing.
And I like Howell, too. I mean, that's a really hard question you asked.
Yeah. Well, I also think that – speaking of, we talked about it. We referenced it with Narduzzi. We talked about it with Mike Gundy. But Bronco Mendenhall doesn't want to play football like this. But he's doing it. And I think that's a testament to being able to adjust. All right, so what do we got? We got to get into
– let's get into a couple games before we wrap up for the week. Sure. So the big game that we've been waiting weeks for, actually, in Big Ten country is Ohio State, Michigan State. And the first thing that I keep thinking about is just how miserable it would be to be on either of these defenses preparing for this game, watching film, especially Michigan State. I mean, they're like the actual worst passing defense in the country. And you're going to be going up against CJ Stroud and company. Like, that's not going to be fun. It's not going to go well. And so I just sort of wonder, I mean, I think Ohio State's going to win this game. But I just sort of wonder, like, which defense I put faith in, if at all, in this matchup.
For me, I don't have faith in either one of them. What we're doing is splitting hairs. One team is 108th in pass defense, and the other team is 130th. Both of you guys aren't good. Neither one of them is good. So to me, and this is what I wrote in the doc, it's which offense can bail out the defense or bail out the defense more. And we've seen both of them make explosive plays. I think there's probably more playmakers for Ohio State than there are for Michigan State. And I think that is probably going to be the difference in the football game. But this is going to be one of those games where when you're watching it, if you flip channels and come back to it, somebody's going to have scored. You know what? This game is probably going to be the thing that most people think all Big 12 football is. It's going to be this. So I am looking forward to watching it. Obviously, this is a game that my wife, who went to Michigan State, is very excited. Like, she's like, not excited for.
Terrified for.
She's terrified. But I'm glad it's a noon game because I will be at work. So,
yeah, I think it'll be really fun. I think the Big 12 comp is very accurate. And we've seen Ohio State against, again, more solid defenses score at will and score on every possession. So this is going to be – it's going to be about holding serve and getting to the end zone. So that'll be fun. So there's actually a ton of great games, obviously, unsurprisingly, late November. Want to get your thoughts on SMU Cincinnati, because this feels like it will be – well, it's been Cincinnati's biggest game on the schedule for the back half of the season for a while, but they've just been so sluggish in recent weeks. And, you know, we've talked a lot about style points and how they're winning and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it feels like SMU is going to – have a real shot to win this game. I'm just curious what, when you think about this matchup, what jumps out?
So the big thing for me is I don't think they're sluggish. I think they're probing.
Okay.
And by that, you've covered Olympic sports, you've covered gymnastics, and you know how, like, in for gymnasts, when they train, they go into that foam pit?
Yes.
Because they're trying stuff, but they don't want to get hurt.
Yes. But they're making actual mistakes as well, though. They are turning the ball over.
They're turning actual mistakes. But the big thing for me with Cincinnati is they're probing and finding and looking. None of their second halves look like the first halves. Their second halves don't look like that first half. Right. Why? Because they're figuring stuff out and they're taking the temperature and they're probing and they're prodding and they're poking and they're looking. And I think that's really, that's a different thing than most teams. That's a different thing than, it's just a different approach to the game, like the way that they do it, because they know they can always rely on their defense. We can always lean on our defense to get the, I mean, hell, they had to lean on that defense with that. What was that, 2 weeks ago with the fumble and the whole deal? That was a nightmare. Stand.
Yes, yes.
That was insane. But they poke and prod. So they have, yes, they have more interceptions in the first half than they have in the second half. They also have more touchdowns in the second half than they have in the first half. And they find what they're looking and they're testing and looking for things. And I think that's an interesting element that they bring to the table. Like the same thing when you look at them on the back end from a running standpoint. Second half is where they find a lot more space. And it's not always more yards, but it is a lot more scoring opportunity. And it is more, they make a lot fewer mistakes in the second half. Did I do fewer better than less on that one? Did I get that
right?
Yes,
you did it right. I like how you knew that I would know.
Yeah. They make fewer mistakes in the second half because the first half is a lot of them probing. And it's like a kid, like the first time you go to the haunted house and you have the peeled grapes and you're like, I don't know what this is. And then the second time you're like, I just don't want to touch that, so it's fine. They're doing all those like slow, slight probing moves. And then in the second half, they're like, well, we know what we have to do to win. And I think it's very interesting to watch. I think they're going to be fine this week. I'm very curious to see what defensively, if they do something different. Because that's the part where I think that Luke Fickell still has some sort of an ace that he's waiting to pull out. And I don't know if it comes out now against SMU. Or does it come out in, 2 weeks, 3 weeks against Houston? So we'll see.
Okay, quick thoughts on the third biggest game, based on my estimations, Oregon-Utah. Now, this might be the first of twice. We might see this game twice. Oregon's been very interesting lately. I feel like they're, Oregon fans have been pushing back at the way that their team has been kind of dissected.
Discussed.
Yeah, and discussed. How do you see Oregon right now?
I think they're really good. I think they're tough. And I think they're tougher than people give them credit for being. Just because they wear, like, cool uniforms. People think they're, like, this, like, fancy finesse team. But they're tough. They're mean. Their offensive line is mean. Their entire defense is mean. Those dudes are mean as hell. They punch. They fight. I'm not going to say that. But, yeah, they'll hit you in the mouth. So, it's just one of those things that I love watching them play. You give me Noah Sewell any day of the week, and if I could get a team with Noah Sewell and N'Kobe Dean on it, oh my goodness, we are gonna kick you. We're gonna kick your Happy Meal behind up and down Main Street. Like, good grief! And so I love that about them. Obviously, they've got one of the best pass rushers, it's not just that Thibodeau's a good pass rusher. It's that you have to pay attention to five so much that other things happen. And I think that's an important, he's got this Jadeveon Clowney effect to the game where whenever he's in the game, everyone is paying attention to him. Everyone is looking at where he, like the announcers are like, they circle him on games, like on live, not on replay. They circle him on live. And I mean, a couple tackles for loss against Washington State, but you focus on that. And then these other guys are just like, oh, my life just got easier. And whether it's, Dorius, the freshman, Swinson, like these guys are, able to play a freer form of football because everybody's worried about what Five's going to do over here. Oh, no, this guy made a play. So it's going to be that. That's what I think about Oregon. With respect to Utah, though, Utah, another team we didn't talk about, but they fit into the same thing with Narduzzi and Gundy going against type. They average almost a touchdown more than they did over the last six seasons. Cam Rising is a surprising runner in terms of he does it and it surprises defenses and they are not prepared for it at all. And I think that's a great element to his game that a lot of people just don't account for. They find space in the passing game, but they still have that rough, rugged Utah-ness to them. They still show blitz and bail. They still show blitz and blitz. They still don't show blitz and then blitz. And they do all the stuff you want them to do and what you expect a Kyle Whittingham team to do. They're just not as good at it defensively as they have been. But offensively, this is a team that they find space on the ground. And what is it? I got it right here. I know exactly what the thing I wanted to say was. And then you watch them, and I think it was the Arizona State game, we get a Rising run for a touchdown on a scramble. So you're not accounting for him on the scramble, but on that run, you get a wide receiver coming from the side to just mash out three guys. He brings the guy that's covering him in man with him. Then he blocks a linebacker, and that linebacker trips another linebacker. So he's got – that's a 1-for-3. And it's amazing. That's in the first quarter, 4 minutes and 34 seconds. Rising's able to get that done. I think the other part for me, you look at them in, I think it's the third quarter, the third quarter touchdown they have from a wide receiver. And he catches the ball. He catches it, starts to catch at the 6, finishes the catch at the 4. And there's guys all around him, 4 guys. But what does he do? He powers through 4 guys to get into the end zone. And they still have this defense forward mentality, even though the defense isn't as good as it has been. They're scoring. If you can take your team from their basically a 6-year average of scoring 29 points a game and push it up to 35, 36 points a game, you're scoring more. It helps your defense out a ton. Can you imagine if Clemson scored 36 points a game? They'd probably be number one.
Yeah, that's more like what we used to see. I think that's gonna be fun. I think we're gonna get it twice. I think it's gonna be good. I mean, there's a lot going on. So I want to get to our last calls because there's still teams to talk about and stuff going on that we haven't even hit on. So our last call segment for those who are new is a rant or a rave about anything. A lot of times we do it non-football related. Mine's football related this week, yeah. But it can be anything. It's what you would, you know, be ranting about or getting a final round for at 2 a.m. at a bar or whatever it might be. And my last call this week goes to Jimbo Fisher, who has been trying for weeks to shoot down rumors and reports attaching him to the LSU job. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of people, rightfully so, because we all know how this works, until LSU announces a new coach, will still keep that in the back of their minds that the guy who hired Jimbo, gave him the contract at A&M, is the guy making the decision at LSU.
Yep.
No buyout, all that stuff. We could talk about all of that. But my last call just goes for Jimbo for these incredible quotes. Like, these are actually great, a great way of trying to shoot this down. He said, "We're going to recruit an unbelievable class this year. So I'm the dumbest human being on God's earth to recruit all these guys to A&M so I can go across over there to LSU and play against them."
Yep.
And that is one of the best ways I have ever heard a coach shoot down interest. Obviously, you know, you have to be in the same division and things like that for this to work.
Sure.
But maybe it's finally convincing some people. He you know, said, "I want to be at A&M. I plan on being at A&M, not going anywhere." Asked reporters, like, "Am I clear enough? Am I being clear enough?" You know, because this has been weeks of the same questions. And again, I understand why everyone's asking them and why people are skeptical. But I just thought that this was an incredible way to put it from Jimbo Fisher. He is right. He is bringing in an incredible class. He's got incredible players. He's got a blank check. All his guaranteed money at A&M. But I just thought it was again, not refreshing, because we've, you know, Mike Tomlin's had some great denials lately. Like, we've had some great quotes lately, but I just thought that this was peak. This is an all-timer in denying job interest. So cheers to Jimbo Fisher.
Yeah, I know. I think it's great. As someone who, I'm not a hunter, but I do aspire to have a little bit of land. I'm more of a farmer, but when he said the line about I've got ranches and I got good hunting land, I was like, yeah, he's not going anywhere. This guy's very happy. Like, are you kidding me? Like, he's doing his thing. So yeah, for me, I'm gonna stick in the SEC. It took a long time, but on Saturday night against Tennessee, Georgia was fun, and it took them getting pushed by Tennessee in the first quarter and a half. It took them realizing that we do have to do something, some different things, and they've been building to this. In the Florida game, Stetson Bennett got on the hop a little bit, and adding so there's three things that I really love about what Georgia's doing, and I hope folks pay attention to. One, Stetson Bennett running.
Yes,
it's awesome. He ran for 58 yards. If you take out the sacks, he ran for 58 yards. That reminds me a lot of, Steven Garcia at South Carolina, who ran for like 35, 37 yards or something again in their 2010 upset of Alabama. But it's enough. That 30 to 50 yard range, if he can do that every game that matters, every game that they need him to, whether that's Bama or obviously in this case Tennessee, that changes the dynamic of the defense and forces them to play something different. And I don't think enough people have talked about that. The other part is offensively what they've been doing, and this is all offense. We talked about the defense before, but this is all offense. They run 12 personnel with tempo, and 12 personnel, one running back, two tight ends with tempo. It forces the defense to not substitute, and it forces the defense. If you just see the numbers that are on the field, whether it's 19, 86 or zero, you see those numbers on the field, you're like, okay, they're heavy. We need more linebackers in the game. And then when they split them out or flex them out or move them around, you have to account for those pieces, which creates more space in the run game for Zamir White. I know I said three things, but I'm going to go with the fourth one. James Cook, I love him. I understand that he is a bit of a knucklehead to a lot of people. And he was that when I was covering him when we were at the opening. But it was super fun and very awesome and incredibly fast and remarkably dangerous for what he was capable of doing. So I'm glad he's gotten it together and is able to be a contributing piece of this team and a wild gadget for Georgia to use. So I'll call that 2B. And then for the original three, Georgia going 23 personnel to score a touchdown, and you go 23 personnel, that's two tight ends, one running back. And what they were able to do with that, I want to make sure I get the numbers right. I got to get the numbers right because I wrote it down and I put it somewhere because they added so much beef to what they bring to the table that it's scary, like what they're able to do. Here it is. I got it. So we already know every Georgia offensive lineman is over 300 pounds. So we're already looking at 300 times 5. Let's give it, that's 1,500 pounds. 1,500, let's tack an extra 100 pounds on there because we got some guys that are 320, some guys that are 315. So we're looking at 1,600 pounds. Then you go Fitzpatrick, 250. You go Zamir White, 215. You go, Bauer? Bowers, he's 230. Then you throw in the Megatron super freak, Darnell Washington, 265. You're adding in like 900. You're adding almost another 1,000 pounds to the mix. You add another 1,000 pounds to the 1,600 pounds, but then you flex them out. And they had Bauer flexed with Darnell Washington. You send Washington in motion. Can my 6'7", 265-pound tight end block your defensive end, Tennessee? Yeah, he can. So we can pin, and pull out a 300-pounder to block a cornerback, guess what we've got? Zamir White on the hop to block a safety. He misses the block. Does it matter? No. Why? Because James Cook is so fast, he's already in the end zone. Doesn't matter. I love it. They're fun. They're getting fun. They're forcing them to try stuff is the reason why they have Monk in there. I like this. This is – I've been down on Georgia because I thought they should be better than they are offensively, and they're starting to come into it. And I'll say this right now. I'll put it on wax. If they're going to run Stetson Bennett, don't bring JT Daniels back.
I was going to say that staying with Stetson Bennett has also been a decision, and it seems to be the right one.
If he's going to run, leave him in the game because JT's not doing that. And 10-on-11 football versus 11-on-11 football, if you want to win a national championship, you've got a disruptor. And he's not the best runner. He's not that good of a runner. But he is willing to run, and he'll stretch out to get try and get that first down.
Yeah,
and if you're going to add, if you're going to add that element in, leave it in because this does give you a better chance to win a championship than bringing in a guy who can throw the ball far and long.
And we get to use mailman puns, which is more important down the stretch. So we
You know how long we've been calling him the mailman?
Well, what?
Do you know why?
It's the photo, right, of him in the little like the little costume. He talking to the post officer or the postman, and so they got him like a little outfit when he was a kid.
I mean, that's a retrofit of it, sure. But when we were doing camps in 2015, 2016, whatever it was, when we were going to all these Nike camps and everything, he wore a postal worker hat.
Oh, that's right.
He wore a postal worker hat, and it really helped us identify who he was. Nobody else was wearing one of those. Nobody else really even had on a hat at all. Shout out to Damon Damas, who was wearing a bonnet when you're doing camps. But like, we all the kid with the, it was very easy to talk to the guys from Nike, the guys from Student Sports, the guys from wherever, and be like, yeah, that kid's got good squabbles. The kid with the postal service hat, he looks good. He's short. He's a little small, but he looks good. He knows what he's doing. And it's so, we've been calling him that it's old.
Was he wearing it for that reason?
I don't know if he was wearing it for that reason.
To be immediately identifiable as wearing something that other people were not going to wear?
I don't know if he was wearing it for that reason, but I know that on signing.
The post office.
Sure, I think he does. I love the post office too. Listen, my ideal job.
I don't.
My ideal, you don't?
Who likes going to the post office?
Oh, I don't like going to the post office, but if I had my dream job would be to drive one of those right load trucks and deliver mail in a neighborhood with street mailboxes and listen to podcasts all day and have no one talk to me.
I fully believe this.
I'm not joking.
No, I agree. Although you'd hate the weather. You'd have to deal with the weather.
I'm in my truck. I'm delivering packages.
You have to lean out of it and get stuff in and out.
Weather doesn't affect me the way that it affects other people. I'm still wearing shorts.
Okay. All right.
I'm still wearing shorts. Let's wrap up the show. Yep. Folks, rate, review, and subscribe.
Yes, please.
If you're not already an Athletic subscriber, you can go to theathletic.com/subscribe/Nicole. Get that. Go get subscribe under Nicole. Give her some subscripts.
Yes, and also please tweet us and talk to us about your favorite postal office, or post office, postal service takes if you think you could just drive around and not interact with humans all day. We will be back next Tuesday. For more Power Hour, he's Michael Felder. I'm Nicole Auerbach. Thanks for listening.